From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Political junkie Ken Rudin returns this hour on The Exchange, a new monthly feature on NHPR that we just kicked off in early September. Each month, Ken will give us his unique take on American politics and how the issues of the day are playing out politically here in New Hampshire and across the nation. For example, with the U.S. now launching airstrikes against the militant group ISIS in both Iraq and Syria, candidates are fine-tuning their messages on foreign policy and mulling over whether politics still stops at the water's edge, as they used to say. That's certainly been a theme in New Hampshire's races, especially in our U.S. Senate contest. This hour, we'll find out more and also take another look at the so-called war on women, a subject that worked well for Democrats in 2012, but may not have the same impact this time around. Let's get your thoughts into your chance to talk with political junkie Ken Rudin. Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken Rudin, welcome back. It's great to have you.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks, Laura.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Ken, a lot of people thought this election might be about the Affordable Care Act or maybe that federal government shutdown we saw a while back or the economy. Here we are, though, Ken, talking about Middle East conflict again and what role the U.S. should play. What are you hearing,
well,
Ken? Yeah.
Well, that's the problem with making predictions well in advance.
Right.
I mean, exactly. We started 2014 by saying, well, the Democrats are going to pay a huge price for the botched rollout of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and all how it's affecting people around the country. Republicans are going to pay a big price for shutting down the government last fall. Polls showed that approval of the Republicans in Congress were down to 7%, which is not good. And yet nobody's talking about the shutdown. Very few people are talking about the Affordable Care Act. And if they are, and which is interesting because from most accounts, it seems to be working. People seem to be satisfied. And yet rather than heralding it as a Democratic accomplishment, many Democrats are just not talking about it at all.
So we're hearing a lot, though, about foreign policy. And we did a couple candidate forums over the past week. We had Scott Brown last Monday. We had Senator Shaheen this week on Tuesday night. And we're hearing a lot about foreign policy, what the U.S. should do. What are some of the big messages that you're hearing some of these candidates say, Ken, when they talk about these airstrikes in Iraq and now Syria?
Well, for the most part, I mean, first of all, if you listen to the congressional debate, and I put the word debate in quotes because Congress really didn't debate what's going on in Iraq and Syria. Basically, they said, yes, we should fund, we should arm, and we should train the Syrian rebels. But first of all, which Syrian rebels? I mean, we tried to train and arm rebels in Afghanistan, and that sure did a great amount of work, a great amount of good. So we don't know exactly what we're doing. And then when President Obama stands up and says, well, there are going to be no troops on the ground in Iraq and Syria over this, and then Martin Dempsey, the Joint Chiefs Chairman, says, well, I'm not so sure about that. There are a lot of members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, both the libertarian right and the anti-war left, saying, wait a second, this is going to be a nightmare. And what's so ironic is that Barack Obama, was elected in 2008 basically opposing the war when so many of his fellow candidates, including Democrats Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, John Edwards, Chris Dodd, all the other Democrats, voted to give the president the authority to go to war in Iraq. Obama was an anti-war candidate from the beginning. And now who would have thunk that at the waning days of his tenure, we're talking about, again, once again, a war in Iraq, and that's not exactly what the Democrats wanted to be talking about.
Yeah, it's an especially tricky needle for Democratic candidates to thread, isn't it, Ken?
It is because, I mean, for the most part, if you're going to divide the parties in any way, and of course, this is simplistic because there are different factions in both sides, both parties. But the Democrats, you know, I mean, one of the reasons Nancy Pelosi became Speaker in 2006 and Obama became president in 2008 was just they're just tired of the war. The Afghanistan and Iraq, it just went on and on and on with no end in sight. And many of these candidates, it's very interesting that I just wonder if George W. Bush or a Republican were in the White House right now, what the Democratic left would be talking about. But right now, there seems to be not a complacency, but almost like a, why do we have to deal with this all over again? And foreign policy, as I say, is not something that was scheduled to be part of the conversation in 2014.
It's not what we thought we'd be talking about, for sure. You know, I want to invite our listeners to join us too, Ken. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Ken Rudin is back, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. He's a longtime expert in U.S. politics and campaign history, and he's joining us once a month on the exchange to talk about the issues of the day, how they're playing out politically here in the Granite State and around the country. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. I've also been struck, Ken, about, you know, how far back do you go in history? I mean, we've got where we're at now with this ISIS and U.S. response. Some Republicans, including Scott Brown, when we sat down with him last week, are saying, look, a year ago, 2 years ago, you know, we warned you guys that ISIS was trouble. And then some people are even going further back. Maybe we shouldn't have pulled out of Iraq so early. And then, you know, how far back do you go? I mean, we're going way back in foreign policy history here.
Well, look, these crises that are going on anywhere in the world, be it in Ukraine, be it in the Mideast, these didn't start during the Obama administration. I mean, not casting a blame on previous presidents, but the fact is these are turmoils that have been going on for a long, long time. And the fact is that there were a lot of Republicans who made the argument in the past several years that we should not trust the administration in Iraq, the president in Iraq, and what we should do is just keep enough troops just in case there is more commotion, more strife, more of a civil war. And we saw that by backing a regime in Iraq that basically put down any kind of Sunni opposition, it just fueled that anger from that has become ISIS. So there are a lot of Republicans who say, I told you so. We should have kept troops on the ground. But in fairness, there are Democrats who said, look, enough is enough already. We've lost too many troops, too many American lives, and for what? And so there was, at the time, no really desire in this country to keep more troops saying, look, enough is enough. There are so many problems here. Let's deal with the problems at home.
So two more political phrases that I keep hearing in this debate, Ken, that I'd love to ask you about. And then there's a couple other subjects that are definitely going on in our races here. Here's a phrase that I've heard a lot lately in our elections: American boots on the ground. How are candidates, Republicans and Democrats, sort of playing with that one? That's a heavy phrase for voters.
Well, it is. And again, as we say, there's such a war weariness in this country, given, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, there's just such an opposition. John Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the House, has really been talking about the most, not that he's calling for boots on the ground, but he, like many analysts, both in Congress and outside, saying that there's no way you can put down a group, a thing like something like ISIS, the Islamic State, without troops. I mean, it's one thing to just, you know, fund the rebels and arm the rebels, but ultimately that's not going to be enough. And again, there are a lot of people who just, as President Obama himself said, that whatever is going on now, this is not going to end in my administration. It's going to go on for years. And again, when you hear about another non-ending conflict in the Middle East with the United States involved, you just shake your head and saying, here we go again.
Well, and one more phrase again that I'm hearing a lot of that's a really tough one for candidates to talk about: we need to have a debate in Congress. Again, this harkens back to the Iraq War, right? I mean, this idea of how far a president can go before Congress steps in. Senator Shaheen, when we talked to her, was, you know, before we do anything big, we need to have a debate in Congress. How is that echoing right now, Ken, and many years ago with Iraq?
Well, you know, if go back to the 2002, whatever you think of the initial U.S. incursion into Iraq under President Bush, President Bush did go to Congress. He did ask for a resolution. He got a long debate. Both sides were clearly heard, and the authorization to go to war was approved. Of course, many Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, and we've talked about this before, have regretted that vote. But having said that, look, if you think of the Vietnam, the so-called Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964, the vote in the Senate, there were only two senators Morse of Oregon and Greening of Alaska, who opposed the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. And basically that was the carte blanche, or at least that's what Lyndon Johnson thought. That was the carte blanche that let us go do what we wanted to do in Vietnam. But this debate was very, very strange. It seemed very perfunctory. It was part of a bigger funding bill. It was not the emotion one would think. When you're debating war and life and death, you think there'd be more concern about that. I mean, part of the debate in the Senate during regarding whether to arm the rebels in Iraq and Syria, Barbara Mikulski, the senator from Maryland, congratulated the Baltimore Orioles for winning the American League East. I mean, that's how serious the Senate took the debate. And, of course, larger questions. What about, again, boots on the ground? How much is the United States going to commit? That debate never happened. And, of course, many candidates are saying that the Congress must come back in the lame duck session at the least to talk it through, but that may not happen either.
Wow. Well, and we've been talking a lot about the U.S. Senate. Ken, how come so much focus on the U.S. Senate this time around? We keep hearing there's a battle for the Senate.
Well, there is. I mean, we've said that the last several cycles, but the Republicans have always come up short, at least the last two cycles. Since the Democrats won back the Senate in 2006, the Republicans said, okay, we're going to come back in 2008 and 2010 and 2012, and each time they fell short. Part of the problem is that the Republicans have shot themselves in the foot, and we could talk about the so-called war on women and how Republicans would talk about things like legitimate rape and things like that, where just drive away female voters and independent voters and centrist voters. But at the same time, we saw this spectacle of the Tea Party challenging less so Democrats and more so establishment Republicans, saying they're too moderate, they're too cozy with President Obama, too cozy with the Democrats, and they're not really truly Republicans. They're rhinos, Republicans in name only. And so the Republican Party was so split that ultimately they either came up with bad candidates or damaged candidates and allowed the Democrats to keep control of the Senate. This year, the Republicans say they've learned their lesson. Many Republicans in the Senate who were challenged by the right, the people like Mitch McConnell and Thad Cochran and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, others like that, have did their homework, prepared for the onslaught, and maybe even they moved even a little bit further to the right, but you don't have the same civil war in the Republican Party that you've had in previous cycles.
All right. And we're definitely going to talk about that after a short break, Ken. And I talked to some of the candidates this past week about that theme as well. So we will talk more in just a moment. I've got some emails and Facebook comments, too, that I want to share with you. All that coming up with political junkie Ken Rudin in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in now with our Fall Fund Drive. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Political Junkie joins us today. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to be a part of our conversation as we look at the landscape for the 2014 elections, both here in New Hampshire and around the country. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ken, just before the break, we were talking about the Democrats trying to revive their 2012 war on women, since it worked well for them 2 years ago, but you seem to be saying it's probably not going to work quite as well for them this time around.
Well, you don't have the kind of Republican candidates who are giving the Democrats the opportunity to take advantage of it. No more, as we talked about, Todd Akin, the candidate in Indiana, ran for the Senate in Missouri, who talked about whether rape was legitimate rape or not. And then you had Richard Murdoch, the Senate candidate from Indiana, who talked about when pregnancy resulted from rape. He said, well, that was God's will. I mean, Republicans would just bang their heads against the wall to those kind of candidates. That's not happening. And when we keep talking about gender gaps, and there certainly is a gender gap, Democrats certainly favor female voters seem to favor Democrats, male voters seem to favor Republicans. But having said that, if anything, it looks like it's the Democrats who have a more dangerous gender gap this year, and we've seen in Senate race after Senate race, we see it in New Hampshire, but we've seen it in other competitive Senate races around the country, that while Democrats still have a majority among female voters, it's not as strong as it had been. Married women and white women still are voting Republican, whereas on the other side, men are overwhelmingly voting for Republican candidates. There's a key Senate race in Iowa where a poll just came out on Sunday that while the Democrat there is leading among women by 13 points, the Republican is leading among men by 25 points. So
wow, you know, that's a big gap.
It is a huge gap. And so when we always talk about gender gap, we always think of, well, the Republicans need to do better, more better. That's a good word. More better with women. But it's really it's the Democrats who seem to have a real trouble with male voters right now.
Well, somebody asked me recently, you know, we were talking about the gender gap and how Republicans are making strides, as you said, Ken, to close that gender gap with women. This person said, OK, what are Democrats doing to close their gender gap with men?
Well, they are talking. I mean, that's a very good question. Actually, we don't hear nobody talks about reaching out to male voters anymore. The Democratic base has still been women, female voters, minorities, the young, urban voters, and those are not necessarily the people who show up in midterm elections. They came out in droves for President Obama in 2008, less so, but still plenty so in 2012. But this year, a lot of people are discouraged. A lot of Democrats are discouraged when you have a president, even in blue states, whose numbers are below 40% or below. It will depress Democratic turnout. And so what they're trying to do, Democrats are trying to do, and I'm not saying that the war on women is not a legitimate issue. I mean, there's questions about pay inequality, pay inequality that are going around with many campaigns that are important to talk about. But some of them are just like, it seems to be a little forced. And I think many Democrats are saying, look, we got to get women out to the polls and we'll do whatever it takes, whether it's forced, you know, fake indignation or not. But we've got to get this our base out, and this is one of the ways to do it.
Well, one of the things that these efforts have focused on in New Hampshire, I'm talking about Democratic efforts to get women to the polls, they're focusing on the personhood plank of the Republican Party platform. And the New Hampshire GOP did adopt this personhood plank recently, Ken. And from what I understand, this is an effort going on in other states. Can you fill me in on that?
Well, this is a personhood is basically defining a fetus with all the right, I guess, from the protecting the fetus from the moment of fertilization. So this is basically a fetus is a person, and so in some ways you can say, well, that if you kill injure a pregnant woman and the fetus dies, or that could be murder. But at the same time, opponents of personhood could make the case that, well, is abortion therefore becomes murder, because, you know, if a fetus is a human being, then you end a pregnancy, you're ending a life. And so the Democrats have put the Republicans on defensive in many places around the country, in Colorado, which is a key Senate race there. Cory Gardner, who's a member of Congress, voted several times for the personhood amendment in the state legislature, and of course he changed his mind. He changed his position when he started running for the U.S. Senate in Iowa. Joni Ernst supported it for many years in the state legislature, and now says, "Look, you know, all I'm saying is that it's just a statement that I support life. I don't want to criminalize abortion. I don't want to send doctors to prison." But the Democrats think that they do have an issue, saying that this is part of the extremist wing of the Republican Party, and they're pushing on this personhood debate very, very strong.
We talked with this about Republican U.S. Senate candidate Scott Brown about it at a forum with him last week. Ken, a listener named Matthew asked him about this plank and how Brown felt about it.
Well, as Matthew probably knows, because I think I know who Matthew is, that I'm a pro-choice independent Republican, so I don't agree with that particular part of the platform. However, I have always felt that we are a big tent party. We have the opportunity to agree or disagree. There's only one person in this world I agree with 100%, and that's that woman sitting right there.
That'll be Gail.
That'll be my wife. And I don't believe that as a party it's healthy to agree 100% of the time. And quite frankly, as you know, I was the most bipartisan senator in the United States Senate, and that is a stark difference between the over 99% voting record of Senator Shaheen with the president.
That's Republican U.S. Senate candidate Scott Brown talking with us last week. By the way, we sat down with Senator Shaheen earlier this week. Ken Rudin, what do you make of that? You know, we're a big tent. I disagree. I want to let you know also that New Hampshire's gubernatorial Republican nominee also disagrees with this plank. So if the top of your ticket disagrees with the plank, why have the plank?
Well, though, ostensibly, you have a plank like that to say what the Republican Party represents. If you go back to presidential conventions and platforms, going back to 1980, the Republican Party has been very, very strongly anti-abortion, very so-called pro-life positions, and they still say that, look, there are a lot of Republicans who, like Scott Brown, well, I don't know about a lot, but there are several Republicans running for the Senate this year who say, look, you know, that's what the party stands for. I happen to be pro-choice. I happen to be, you know, supporting abortion rights, and that's fine. The Democrats seem to have more tolerance, though, with people who break from party orthodoxy than the Republicans. For example, there are a lot of, in the South, you know, a lot of key red states, there are many Democratic pro-life candidates, anti-abortion candidates, and the Democrats in Washington say that's great because, you know, this is a way to win in these kind of states. But on the Republican side, whenever you have a Republican saying I support abortion rights, they're immediately hit with a challenge from the far right. Now, Scott Brown has the luxury of not going from Massachusetts, which of course is a very blue state, to a purple state in New Hampshire, and he did not have to change his views on abortion. But other Republican candidates around the country have not had that luxury. And many of them have said that they're pro-choice to their peril because they'll immediately get hit with a primary challenge, and then, of course, that weakens them for the ultimate general election in November.
Well, something else we heard from Scott Brown in that piece of sound, talking about Senator Shaheen voting 99% of the time, as he says, with the president. And you've talked about this, Ken, how, you know, President Obama is pretty unpopular. That's bringing Democrats down. I asked Senator Shaheen about this in our forum with her this week. Here's what she said.
Well, you know, there are a lot of surveys in Washington. He cites one to get to that statistic. But I think what people need to do is to look at what I've done in Washington, look at what I've done in New Hampshire, and make a decision based on whether or not I've been effective. And if you look at my work in a bipartisan way, whether it's with Rob Portman on energy efficiency, whether it's with Senator Ayotte.
So here we have both Shaheen and Brown, Ken, talking about their bipartisanship. I wonder about that message in this supposedly hyper-partisan era. Here we have Brown saying a lot of the time, I'm the 50-50 guy, you know, I voted half the time with the other party. Here we have Senator Shaheen promoting her bipartisan credentials. What do you think? Are you hearing that elsewhere?
Well, yes, and I'm smiling. I was smiling listening to Senator Shaheen's answer because if you go back to 2008 when she was running against John Sununu for the Senate, she accused Sununu of voting with President Bush, 87% of the time or 97% of the time. I mean, when you have an unpopular president on the ballot or not, the opposing party will try to link his or her opponent with the unpopular president. That's exactly what Democrats did very effectively in 2008. This person is a clone of President Bush. It's, he or she voted with Bush 97% of the time. So, of course, it comes back to bite you 6 years later, as it has for many Democrats around the country, when you have an unpopular president, and then these Democrats who very closely ran with Obama in 2008, now 6 years later saying, well, I'm completely independent and nobody's more of a critic of President Obama than myself because I'm a real independent. So
you hear this elsewhere too then? Is that what you're
saying? It happens all over the country. So many Democrats, Kay Hagan, the senator from North Carolina, the senator Mark Pryor in Alaska, in Arkansas, Mark Begich in Alaska, they all ran. They were very happy to be part of the Obama ticket in 2008. In 2014, they say, oh, no, we are completely independent. This is, the president has his views. I respectfully disagree. When you hear Alison Lundgren Grimes, who's running against Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, Mitch McConnell's running against the Obama-Grimes ticket, as so many Republicans are around the country. And she says, oh, no, I'm not Obama. Obama's not on the ballot. But of course, she'll say, but I am a Clinton Democrat. And of course, in a state where Bill Clinton remains very popular, she'll gladly say that I'm a Clinton Democrat. certainly not an Obama Democrat, in a state where President Obama is deeply unpopular.
Again, our phone number for you to join us with political junkie Ken Rudin, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email, Ken, that turns from the U.S. Senate to one of our congressional races here in New Hampshire. And as you know, New Hampshire's congressional districts really can go either way. Christopher says, I'm wondering about Marilinda Garcia's chances in New Hampshire's second CD. She ran pretty hard right in the primary, Christopher says. How does she come back to the center and appeal to moderates and independents in the general election? And I'm sure you know, Ken, the second district in particular in New Hampshire is known as really a more moderate district. It's voted in Democrats, Republicans, but it's voted Democrat in the presidential years a couple times now running. So it leans a little more Democratic.
Yes, but when you think of New Hampshire history, I mean, if memory serves, this is the district that Jim Cleveland, the moderate Republican, held for many, many years. That was the kind of Republicans who would win regularly in New Hampshire, fiscally conservative, but socially kind of moderate. Whereas the caller is exactly right. Garcia ran well to the right in the primary. There are a lot of Republicans in New Hampshire would have liked a different, would have preferred a different Republican candidate to basically, since it's kind of a swing district, leaning Democratic, you don't want somebody hard right. Now, she at the same time, she is a very attractive candidate, and I mean that in background and resume. She's considered a rising star. To have a Latino candidate and a Republican is, of course, one of the dream one of the dreams for people who recruit candidates. But you know, and Richard Nixon historically said over and over again that you run to the right in the primary and then you try to move to the center in the general election. It may not be that easy for Garcia because, you know, having been very, very conservative, she's, you know, again, she supports the personhood bill. She's very strong on abortion. She had Ted Cruz coming into New Hampshire to campaign for her. Ted Cruz, I don't see as the kind of Republican who will do well in a New Hampshire electorate. I mean, one of the reasons Scott Brown is doing so well is because he is that moderate conservative that New Hampshire has voted for so many, many years. But again, you know, sometimes you could be, we saw this in 2010, many of the candidates who ran as a Republican were very, very conservative. I'm almost like sometimes extreme conservative, but if you have a national wave behind you, if you have an unpopular president to run against, that could win out overall. So I think ultimately, while the Democrats saying that Garcia is too extreme, you know, she can say that I'm running against the Obama Custer, you know, agenda. And we'll see which one wins out in November.
Well, and speaking of those political waves, Ken, our first district has been especially subject to those national political waves. And I'll ask you about that in just a minute. We're going to check in very quickly with our fall fun drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're pondering politics this hour with political junkie Ken Rudin. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken, just before the break, we were talking about the way our first and congressional districts have gone here in New Hampshire. And I read something in the National Journal, actually, this morning that said our first district especially has been subject to those political waves.
Well, that's true. And, you know, whenever you think of New Hampshire politics, of course, you always think of the presidential primary. And there are so many great stories, tremendous lore with New Hampshire going back to 1952. But when I think of New Hampshire, I think of that when there is a national wave, when there's something going on in the country, nobody seems to be affected. No state seems to be affected more than New Hampshire, and especially this congressional district. I mean, if you think of the big Democratic wave in 2006, when the Democrats won the House and Nancy Pelosi became Speaker, then you had Carol Shea Porter beating Jeb Bradley in 2006 and taking that House seat. In 2010, with the big rise of the Tea Party and the big Republican wave around the country, then you had Shea Porter losing her seat in 2010. And then in 2012, when President Obama won New Hampshire and did well around the country, then the Democrats gained the seat back. So whenever you think of tidal waves around the country, no state better embodies that than New Hampshire. I mean, I think I was in New Hampshire at a New Hampshire public radio event, I guess, last month, and I actually met somebody who's not a member of the state legislature, because I think basically everybody's a member there. But, I mean, the fact is that there are huge turnarounds. If there's a Democratic wave, you see dozens and dozens of members thrown out of office, and if it's a Republican wave, the same thing. It's fascinating to watch, and no more so than this congressional district.
Well, and some of the statements that Carol Shea Porter has made, and Ann McLean Custer in the 2nd District, against their opponents, you keep hearing Tea Party, Tea Party, Tea Party, Tea Party, Ken. Here's Carol Shea Porter. She says, Frank Ginta is flying the Tea Party flag for the third time and is too extreme for our state. We've heard similar phrases from Democrats in the 2nd District. How much do you hear the Tea Party phrase being used in these races this year? And how much does it really matter this time around?
Well, that's a good question. That's a real question. I mean, you do hear it a lot. Every Republican is, I mean, Frank Ginta is hardly a Tea Party Republican. He's hardly one of those extreme right wingers that you do see running around the country, running for office around the country. But I mean, as far as whether it plays well, it may have played well in 2012. I suspect that if anything, it might hurt the Democrats in 2014. And just like the Republicans are running around the country campaigning against Harry Reid. Now, aside from Harry Reid's family, who knows who Harry Reid is? I mean, of course, he's the Senate Majority Leader, but you see these commercials. He votes with Harry Reid. I mean, it's one thing to run against Newt Gingrich, as the Democrats have done for years, and it's one thing for Republicans to run against Nancy Pelosi, but you have these pollsters basically tell you that running against Harry Reid is a good idea, or running against the Tea Party is a good idea. But I think people who know, the problem with Shea Porter's argument here is that voters know Frank Ginta. I don't know if they like him. I don't know if they like her so much. But the point is, they know who he is. And to say, to brand every Republican opponent, every Republican candidate as somebody who's a Tea Party, you know, Tea Party kind of disciple, I think it just wears thin.
Well, we do hear these messages again and again from both sides. You know, I could throw out five phrases here, you know, Tea Party, Big Oil, Wall Street, you know, and so on. Some of that comes from the advertising, Ken, and some of the advertising, a lot of it is done by outside groups not officially connected with the candidates. Here's a Facebook comment from Lauren, kind of along those lines. Does Ken see any way for the U.S. to change the way elections are funded? In other words, Lauren asks, can we get big money out of elections and have it focus on candidates and issues instead? Lauren, thanks for the Facebook comment.
Let me think for a second. No.
Really?
No, of course not. Because, I mean, who's going to decide? I mean, if you're going to change the way campaigns are funded, who's going to decide? It's the incumbents who vote in Congress about limiting money. And, of course, you know, you can rail all you want about the Citizens United Supreme Court decision in 2010. You can rail about all that you want about all this money that's in politics. But the truth be told, I mean, President Obama did not shy from raising money, more money than any other Democrat in history. Matter of fact, when he could have taken federal matching funds, and limited his campaign spending in 2008, he decided, no, I'm going to go outside the system. So both parties realized that it's to their advantage to have as much money as possible. And, you know, for all the criticism about all these Supreme Court decisions about corporations, now they're spending untold numbers of money. Well, the unions can spend money as well. And we've seen in 2014 that many of the unions who got their head handed to them in gubernatorial races around the country, Scott Walker in Wisconsin is a good example, perhaps Rick Snyder in Michigan, the unions are finally getting off from their defeats of the past and saying, wait a second, we do have political clout, we'll use it. So, you know, I mean, we could always say that, you know, money, there's just too much money in politics, but it depends on what you do with it. Just go back to 2012, Obama and Mitt Romney. They both had tons and tons of money. Mitt Romney blanketed the airwaves around the country with ad after ad after ad. President Obama used the money to get out the vote efforts, with organization, with you know, you talk about boots on the ground.
The ground game, right.
Well, the ground game in the country, not ringing doorbells. That old kind of politicking still works. And so you could talk about too much money, but it always depends. It really depends on what you do with the money. And Obama had the right message for that money spent in 2012.
You know, you mentioned something about a governor's race. And I did want to ask you about that, Ken. How much do gubernatorial races matter in terms of how well the Republican ticket does or the Democratic ticket does?
Well, of course, you know, obviously the concern, the focus this year is on the battle for the Senate. We really haven't gotten a chance to talk about those races.
Right.
There's some big, big Senate races out there. But, you know, the gubernatorial races are important as well. And people forget that when everybody complains about, oh, the redistricting and the safe congressional seats, well, it's the governors and the state legislatures who draw the line. So these are very, very crucial. And the point, another point is that everybody looks at Washington and say, well, nothing gets done because everybody's bickering and everybody just cares about reelection and things like that. If policy is being changed anywhere, if policy is being made anywhere, it is at the gubernatorial election and who your individual gubernator is. So, I mean, you could talk about taxes.
Gubernator.
Yeah, exactly. welfare and taxes and immigration and all these things, it's basically being done at the state level. So you do have some big, big races in 2014 that either could, I mean, look, you think of Bill Clinton, think of George W. Bush. These were governors who came out of the gubernatorial politics of their states to be elected president, which is unusual because in the past, all the focus had been on the Senate. This governor class of 2014 is significant. All the big governors are up, and some of them could fall, and that's going to be very interesting when you look at 2016 calculations.
So if a congressional candidate is struggling, you know, is he or she helped if the gubernatorial candidate is strong? I mean, that top of the ticket helps pull somebody up if they're having a hard time?
Possible, but you know, you look at, like, you look at, for example, in New York and California, the two biggest states where the two respective Democratic governors, Andrew Cuomo and Jerry Brown, are running away with the election, but they're not spending that much, they're not really campaigning that much because they just don't, either they feel it's below them to campaign, or so you would think that Democrats in these two states would latch on to Brown and Cuomo for a top of the ticket poll, but if they're not spending, if the governors are not caring that much, then maybe there is no top of the ticket, and maybe more voters are voting more independently than ever before. But then you have these other states like Pennsylvania, where the governor Tom Corbett is probably going to lose next month. And the last time a governor of Pennsylvania was defeated for reelection was, as you well remember, 1857. So there is a tidal wave going on with governor's races as well, and there's a lot of shakeup going on at the state level.
One last question for you, and this is a Facebook comment from Caroline. Has to do with what you talked about, Ken, Washington bickering and so forth. Caroline says, how the heck do we end up with such a bunch of entitled, useless individuals all out for themselves? She says, I suppose this is the result of the money grab and selling out that goes on in Congress. I did see an ad on TV the other day, Ken, that did talk about rock bottom congressional approval ratings, and yet most incumbents will get reelected. So, Caroline, thank you for your comment, and Ken, I'd love your thoughts.
Well, isn't that remarkable? If everybody says they hate Congress and they hate the way Congress is, but if you looked at the whole year in congressional primaries, just four members of the House and not a single member of the Senate was defeated in the primary. So if you think that, oh, these guys are really terrible and we got to get rid of them, there seemed to be no significant opposition in the primaries. I mean, it's always tough to defeat somebody in the primaries, but it just seems like as much as we say that we can't stand these guys, it's just tough to vote them out. So, I mean, we'll see what happens on November 4th. There are a bunch of senators who are running for re-election who could be in big trouble, and it's very possible the Republicans could take control of the Senate. But ultimately, for what purpose? I mean, if the Republicans win the Senate, then what? Is there suddenly gridlock in Washington? I mean, it just doesn't seem to work either way. And at some point, voters are going to have to come to sit down and think to themselves, saying, wait, something's got to work. This is not working. And I don't know if we have to leave the two-party system or something, but anything is better than what we have now.
Well, speaking of November 4th, you'll be back up here, right? Joining us on Election
Night. I'm very excited. I'm going to be in the studio with you on Election Day, and we'll be talking about all this stuff.
All right. Ken, thank you so much. Really appreciate it, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Ken Rudin, host of The Political Junkie. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in now and see how that fall fund drive's going.